Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 362 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host as usual. And today my guest is Richard Sullivan. Richard heads up a very successful family law practice in Orange County, California. And he's been doing so now for the better part of 40 years. So he has tremendous perspective on how things in the legal space have changed over the course of time. It also comes from a very small town in Missouri, so you can imagine how his experience in small town America then getting transplanted to Southern California, how that might also influence and impact his practice of law. So very casual conversation he and I have. And I hope you get something from listening to it. So without any further delay, here is Richard Sullivan. Richard Sullivan, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you with us today. Richard, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Okay. I born and raised in Missouri, a small town called St. Paul, Missouri. Had a blinking red light, or amber light in the middle of the town.
Just had one.
That's right. Had sixth, seventh, and eighth grade in one classroom. We were taught by the nuns. And after I got out of eighth grade, I went into town called O'Fallon, Missouri. And they had a stoplight there, I think, and graduated high school. I was going to spend my days driving tractors and combines, but Vietnam broke out, or was going on, I should say. Mm-hmm. So there, I was going to either get drafted or get deferred by going to school. So I went to Southeast Missouri State, got a teaching credential, and taught high school for approximately 3 years. And I tried to get in law school in Missouri, but they wouldn't accept me because I was not academically appropriate at that time. So I applied for law school in California. I got accepted by Western State, which is a for-profit law school, and they typically take your money and flunk you out within the first couple of years. And they didn't flunk me out. I passed the California bar the first time and began practicing law some 45 years ago, as of today, roughly.
Wow.
So my idea was to go back to Missouri and practice with my daddy. I was adopted back there by a man, George Sullivan, who was an attorney in the small town of O'Fallon, and I was going to be a lawyer, and so I was going to practice law out here for 5 years because the school I graduated from was not ABA at the time, but by the time I was ready to go back to Missouri, he had passed, and so I stayed.
So your father in a small town, I'm guessing, was more of a general practitioner, and addressed a lot of different types of legal issues.
That's so true. And I remember one of his cases, a black man killed a white man in the outside of a pool hall in O'Fallon. And the case went to Hannibal, Missouri, where Mark Twain was from. And my daddy was asked to go there to try the case because they couldn't get a lawyer in that area because of the threats. So my dad went up there and tried the case. He took me with him. I saw, you know, half the courtroom full of whites, half the courtroom full of blacks. And when the jury found the man not guilty, all hell broke loose. And we were soon escorted out of town and never went back. But I do remember the family of the black man brought us a cord of wood every fall for probably 10 years. They were so grateful to my dad.
Real life, Kill a Mockingbird kind of story.
Yeah.
I always really like to hear the stories about old town, small town lawyering. In fact, to be honest with you, to some degree, that interest helped spark this podcast because my wife's uncle was a very prominent attorney here in the area in which I practice. And he would tell these delightful stories about when Rockville, Maryland, which is the county seat here, was, generally speaking, a rural town within the county, and how the courthouse was kind of a traditional old school environment where you had, you know, half a dozen judges and they served more or less for life, and not the same kind of legal environment that we have now, and your reputation was everything.
Mm-hmm. You know,
which I think, sadly, these days, I'm not sure young attorneys pay a lot of attention to that. You know, they think their reputation is what people are saying about them on social media.
Well, and just to address that point, when I taught law school, I taught trial practice with a judge named Myron Brown, and he and I would tell the lawyers, so one thing that you have that you should never give up is your reputation. That's everything in this community. So guard it with your life. Don't lie to the court. Don't lie to your clients. Don't cheat and steal. And I firmly believe that that is an asset that should be protected at all costs.
So this family attorney friend said to me when I went to law school, and I've said many times I went to law school late, he said to me, always be a gentleman. Be a gentleman to the court. Be a gentleman to the people who work in the court. Be a gentleman to opposing counsel, to the defendant, the individual on the other side of the aisle from you, because they'll always remember you as being someone that was respectful and acted in a proper manner. You don't want them remembering you because you were a jerk. And that so resonated with me and stuck with me. And so when I started this podcast, I was thinking, I want to interview some of these old-time attorneys, the ones that look back 50 years within the county, maybe some of the judges. But then I figured I would run out of guests pretty quickly. You know?
Yeah.
There weren't that many. And I thought, well, let me think about that. Maybe there's a different thing I could do the podcast on, and that's how we came to create the Law Entrepreneur.
I agree with that concept that you just stated. I mean, kindness begets kindness, right? Usually. And, you know, when you're in a deposition, if you're an asshole, the guy clams up and doesn't want to say anything, or she clams up. And if you're kind, they start talking to you, and you get a lot more information out of the individual.
Sure.
by being kind and appropriate. So I totally agree with you. And when you walk into a courtroom, as you say, you're kind to the bailiff, you're kind to the clerk, the court reporter, obviously the bench officer, and people like you. And it's important to be liked, right? Going into, you know, battle, so to speak, or putting on your case. So I totally agree that be a gentleman.
I remember the first time I met a surly attorney who was representing the opposing party in my case. And we met for the first time. And within a couple of minutes, he had already insulted me and then was pretty, uncooperative and beyond just advocating for his client. It was just being a jerk. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to call this guy out. I said, listen, and he was a young guy, too, who went to my law school. And I said, you know, I'm just shocked that you would be so surly and so disrespectful and so insulting the first time we meet. I mean, if it was the 10th time and I'd given you a cause, something. We just met. And beyond that, you know what I did before I was an attorney, became an attorney, right? No, I don't really care. I said, well, you might, because I owned and operated a martial arts school. I'm a fourth degree black belt. So I don't think you want to insult me any further.
So, yes. No, you know, I agree with that. Sometimes lawyers do that to put on a show for their client.
Of course, yeah.
And then it's ridiculous. Yeah, if it goes overboard, there's a time to stop it and you know, just delay the proceeding, perhaps, if it's in a deposition in the courtroom. If that happens, the judge will usually take control of the courtroom.
Yeah.
And not allow it to go forward anymore. So, yeah, it's important to be kind, to be graceful and appropriate to people. Because in family law, they're in the stress position, right? They're emotionally charged in family law. Like when I did criminal law and bad guys sometimes shackled, but when they went into the courtroom, the bad guys always behaved, right? They always knew, you know, they're good for one of the charges that they're being charged with. But in family law, you know, so I had bad people at their best in criminal law, and in family law, you have good people at their worst.
Yeah. Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. And then you got to recognize that, because, you know, in my practice of 45 years, I've testified in two homicide cases where they killed my client. One time they wanted me to be there to kill me also. So the lawyer, by charging or acting inappropriate at the other side, usually that's not a good idea for a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons, yeah.
A lot of reasons.
Well, you avoided the small town legal experience. I'm having a brain cramp right now. The famous author writes legal novels situated mostly in Oxford, Mississippi.
I know who you're talking about.
I'll think of it in a second.
Okay.
But you avoided that life and made your way out to California. So when you graduated, did you go to work for another firm, big firm, small firm? How did you eventually get to the point where you started one of the preeminent family law practices in Southern California?
Well, when I graduated law school, there was a guy named, they call him Cash Cole, Walkie Cole, and he came into the law library and he said, "Who here has passed the bar?" And I raised my hand and I was the only one. So he said, "Ken, I'm going to give you a job." So I went on a Saturday. Yeah.
Oh, that's some interesting recruiting technique.
Yeah. And Walkie Cold, all he did was low grade work. He did misdemeanor, drunk in public, juices, driving under the influence, prostitution cases, all of these, you know, misdemeanor cases. So when he hired me on Monday morning, he gave me a file. He says, "Go try this case." And I didn't know how to try a jury trial. I mean, I've been a lawyer in New York minute. And I tried the case, got a hung jury, and went on doing criminal cases. And I thought I was going to do criminal law there on out. And when I tried all the cases, because the guy never tried a case in his life, he always had hired somebody to do it for him. When he ran out of trials for me, I was let go. And so I rented a small office in the B of A tower in downtown, in Orange. And there was a big brouhaha with two lawyers up there. One was doing drugs and the other one was trying to have him stop doing drugs. And there was a big fight and the police were called. And I was asked to step into the lawyer's shoes and the family law aspects. And so I did. And that's how I kind of, right place, right time, start doing family law.
Well, it's kind of, yeah. Yeah, my first job was some guy just walked into the library and said, "Hey, who's passed the bar?" And I got my second job with two lawyers got into a knockdown, drag out fight, and somebody had to fill in because the trial was coming up. That's fortuitous timing.
It is. It really was. My dad used to say, 90% of life is showing up. So I'd show up every day and yeah, I got the nod and kind of took off from there. But I did hook my wagon. You know, well, at that time, I knew the courtroom. I was very good at the evidence code. I was very good in the courtroom, knew nothing about family law, you know, 40 somebody years ago, We didn't have a family law code in California at that time. So,
wow.
So in any event, I began to read and take lessons in family law, and I became very proficient at it, I think. So, and I enjoy doing that today. I enjoy trying cases today.
And so did you maintain your own firm throughout the next 40 years?
No, I was asked to join this gal called Lisa Hughes, and she was the piranha of the family lawyers in Orange County. Everybody told me not to go with her, and I stayed with her for 11 years. Her and I built a huge practice. She was a CPA and a family lawyer, and we did quite well together for 11 years, and then it was just time to go our separate ways, which we did. That kind of brought my star up in the family law field. And I joined a couple, well, people joined me and they stole money from me and did other things. And so I went now on my own for the last probably 8 years now.
Okay. So along the way, clearly you've seen a lot, and it's not like you just fell off the back of the truck and were able to create a practice. You saw things that worked, things that didn't work, and have created your current firm in the image of what you feel provides the best for your clients. So tell me, what are some of the bedrock principles that guide Sullivan Law and Associates in their provision of legal services in the family?
Well, I think number one is honesty to the client. You know, typically, and in fact, I had an interview with a client before we started this podcast, and I walk in and I meet her and I said, you know, my job is to be honest with you, like it or not. I mean, I have to tell you the truth, and you may not want to hear some of these, what I see in your case, or you may want to hear it. I don't know, but my job is to tell you the truth about what we can do, what we cannot do, how long is it going to take, probably, how much it's going to cost, probably. And I told her, there's a cost-benefit analysis in family law. You know, how much do you want to spend as to what you get for that money spent? So we try to be absolutely honest with our clients to give them realistic expectations. If you set that right away, you're really ahead of the game getting to the conclusion of the case, I believe.
I remember a client who said to me one time, It's not really about the money, Neil. I want to teach them a lesson. I want to make a point.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, well, you're probably going to need to look for another attorney, because I'm not in the lesson teaching mode.
And, yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, the court isn't either.
Right.
They're not going to punish your ex just because they treated you poorly. Might get some consideration, but you're not going to get the lesson. So that kind of honesty, you know, setting that expectation, cost me a few clients, but I think in the end, it's that kind of bedrock principle that you have to build your practice around.
No, I totally agree with that component. Just escaped my mind what I was going to say about that.
Well,
but it's so true. I mean, you have to be honest with them, brutally honest with them. Oh, I know what it was. It's I can't fix him and I can't fix her, and the court is not going to fix him or her. So whatever happens, had happened in the past, it's in the past. It's not going to be probably relevant. And again, it's a cost benefit analysis. So, that's how I look at that process. But usually when they say it's about the principle, it's about money.
It is.
I found that out.
Yeah. And I say it's not about money. It really is.
It is.
About money.
It really is about money.
Yeah.
And, and you got to tell them too, they were divorced. Even when they have children, people divorce to each other, right? They don't divorce from each other when you have kids. Because the way the planet works is that little Johnny or little Mary's going to graduate eighth grade, and they're going to want mom and dad there. Graduate high school, mom and dad are going to want there. There's going to be a wedding, right? Probably there's going to be grandbabies. Unless you two get along and communicate, somebody's not going to get invited.
Yeah.
And so figure it out. That's how the planet works. So you two have to, you know, accommodate your daughter or your son so that at least on the surface, you're amenable or comfortable with one another. So,
yeah. And that conversation frequently also leads to how much are you willing to work with the other side to achieve a result that you guys can live with?
Yeah.
Because if you're not willing to work, if you're just going to throw up obstacles and, you know, pound your fist on the table, we're not going to get anywhere. It's going to cost you a ton of money and you're not going to be happy in the end.
Right. Well, and Neil, I typically have an expression I've used in the courtroom quite a bit, getting a reaction by the bench officer. When I say, you know, Your Honor, that dog don't hunt, they look at me and go, what's that mean, Sullivan? I go, well, it won't work, you know, this.
Yeah.
But, or a closed mouth gathers no foot, you know. But, you know, those kind of things I have
a bunch of Missourism coming out.
I guess that is. Yeah.
So you start your practice evolves and, you're kind of focusing in these days on family law, almost exclusively, right?
Yeah, exclusively family law. Yeah. I mean, family law, you say family law, but it involves, you know, contract and breach of fiduciary duties and custody, visitation and division of pensions. So it's a broad spectrum of family law.
Yeah, of course. Of course. One of the things that we hear, time and time and time again, particularly coming out of the out of the pandemic, is the challenge to finding quality staff and the problems of hiring and evaluating staff. And what's your approach to creating great staff? Because you don't get to be as successful as your firm is if you don't have great people working alongside you.
Well, that's true. I mean, you've got to be able to work with staff and vice versa. And all my lawyers have a paralegal assigned to them. So it's important. And I tell a lawyer, I've said, look, you've got to make this paralegal want to work with you. You have to make, usually it's a her, sometimes it's a him, but usually it's her. And you have to, you know, treat them with respect and dignity. And I don't want to have any yelling or screaming. That we don't do that here. That's not how we roll here. And so I want people that like doing what they're doing. And we typically do an extensive venting process before I even see them to make the call to come aboard in the firm.
Okay.
So, you know, you have to vent them well. You have to look in, you know, historical data, where they worked, what did they do, why did they leave, you know, those types of things. What's their education, skill level, et cetera. But I like happy people. I don't want, you know, I don't want grumpy people. I don't want Eeyores, you know, walk around and mope around. I don't like those. I mean, that's not how we run this office. So
you have what, the 4 or 5 attorneys these days?
5 lawyers, probably 5 paralegals, maybe 6 have support staff.
Sure.
And
I usually have a lot of type of these, like, you know, personality test, personality matrix type of thing, that Briggs-Myers or Wunderlich or anything like that, to kind of match people up.
No. I don't use that. I haven't used that. I've been very fortunate. But you know what? This is what happens. If you're a respected family law attorney, the word gets out that you'd want to work for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even young lawyers will come to me and say, hey, Sullivan, can I work with you? You know, I hear you. I'm gonna work with you. I want to learn from you. So, I mean, staff kind of comes to you as opposed to the firms that have high turnovers and nobody likes them, right? They go, oh, no, this, you know, the judge knows who's coming into their courtroom too. You know, what kind of a lawyer is coming in typically. And we know what type of bench officer we're going to get. So they grade us and we grade them. And the public, you know, in the family law is a small group in Orange County. It probably is the same in LA County. Everybody kind of knows everybody in the family law that does family law. Because we go to the seminars together, we see each other in the courtroom, we see each other in the hallways of the courthouse. Well, you know, the seminar.
That goes back to our point initially, you know, be respectful of opposing counsel because you're going to work with them again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're going to have a case with them again, and you don't want to poison the well on your first go around.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes you're the windshield and sometimes you're the bug, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. It depends on what side of the factual the case you're on. So, yeah.
I know a lot of people who use these personality index, like the Colby exam or the DISCUS, and they get tremendous value out of it. It works for them. It's never really worked for me. I don't know that I've really given a lot of stock to these types of tools for, you know, evaluating staff members. So I probably need to open.
Well, you know about staffing.
But I've always felt like if this person seems to me like I would enjoy working with them, I trust my gut.
I agree with that. You know, and the other thing is that, you know, I'm the boss here, but I don't want to act like the boss. I don't want to have to be that person. I want to be one of us, right? I want to, my door's open. If you got a complaint, if you got a comment, if you got an idea, tell me about it. You know, I'll get your coffee. I don't have a problem with that. You say, hey, Richard, can you get me? Yeah, I'll bring you down a cup of coffee. That's, I don't have that. I don't want to have that attitude. Like, I'm better than you.
Hungry Towers syndrome.
Yeah. I hate.
So,
and
tell me,
I hate lawyers like that.
Yeah. Well, I remember back in my previous life when folks would walk past the Xerox machine to hand something to a secretary to say, can you make copies of this for me? Like, dude, you just walked past the machine. You could have made it yourself.
Yeah. Exactly.
Never really understood that.
Of course, yeah.
I cut my teeth in a shop where the secretaries were unionized. So, They were pretty clear about telling me what they were going to do and weren't going to do.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about then the role that systems or technology plays with your firm.
Well, you know, Matthew runs that end of this firm, and without
Matthew's
him,
your son.
Yes, and without Matthew, we would not have the systems we have. But we are very systems heavy, so to speak. We have technology in the tens, so to speak. As I'm looking at a large conference table, it's probably almost 12, maybe 14 feet long. There's two iPads set up, plugged in on it. We have a huge, probably, I don't know how big the flat screen is on the wall with calendars and dates. And if we can Zoom people and we can get into the courtrooms by virtual earrings. So he's all about that. I wasn't, but he drugged me along, and we are very much in the technical, I guess, end of the field.
Well, we have a, you know, professional responsibility to stay up to date with a minimum level of technology. So I mean, that's the starting point. Firms like yours and others that are really successful are the ones, in my humble opinion, who take that responsibility and take it that next step. Because in the end of the day, it's what's best for the client, right?
Absolutely.
And the client, you know, clients get more and more educated every day. And I suspect if they walked into your office and, you know, there's a certain romantic charm about sitting down with a yellow legal pad.
But
that's all you got?
Yeah, I know. I still use.
Well, I do too, but that ain't all I got, so to speak.
Same here, but we are up to date on all of that. And we train on it. And before the pandemic came, hit us, it was March of 2020. I remember I was in trial. And I told my son, I said, man, I'm worried about this. Something's going to happen. It's coming. And so he had each of our lawyers had the scanner, a computer, and all of the other electronics they needed to work from home. So when we went down, no longer offices, and we were doing hearing virtually, we didn't miss it. It was amazing. Well, it was really amazing.
And I think there's lots of stories like that. I mean, I was one of them. I was a techie, and I was remote and virtual before it was popular to be remote and virtual. And if you weren't able to adapt during the pandemic and create that experience, you were not going to survive.
You were not. Absolutely. You were not going to survive. Yeah.
And I'd say, you know, look, if you were still in, you know, the one stoplight town in Missouri, you have a little more leeway there. But Orange County, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
The hotbed of technology and innovation and entrepreneurship, you better have some credentials in that area or you're going to be perceived to be out of touch.
You know, Anil, the court adapted to it as well because yes. I was putting on domestic violence cases virtually, you know, which, yeah. You know, I didn't feel real comfortable starting at it, but as we kept doing it, you know, for a year, I go, whoa, this is kind of cool. I can have a witness in another state. I can just bring them on virtually and then, you know, do it that way when the court was hesitant to do that before, you know?
Yeah, well, when I first started litigating, the audio visual resources in the court was a paper flip chart.
I remember that. And yeah.
Bring your own markers.
Yeah.
So the court has come a long way and in a very short period of time. And that's welcome.
Yes.
Now
we're trying to go paperless here, but it's tough, you know, but I mean, everything we have has been scanned in, but I still like when I'm going to trial, I want my notebook. I want my paper. I want my exhibits marked. I want to, you know,
Yep. Do it
kind of the old fashioned way. But
no, there's a balance to be made.
Yeah, there is a balance.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap up here. You've had, you know, 40 plus years worked in the legal market. You've seen along that timeline, a lot of things change, improve, get redefined and what have you. And you've been able to keep up with it and prosper in that kind of changing environment. Does anything come to mind where maybe you didn't handle it as well, or you would have done things a little differently thinking back on it, given what you know now?
It probably is. I've done some things that have gotten into kind of hot water. I hit a guy in the courthouse once.
There's that. I'm not sure that that's a good idea.
That was not like, well, I mean, I'm still saying stuff wasn't my fault, but it's just a brief story. I mean, I'm in a courtroom. I finish his trial at 10 o'clock. I'm going to another trial. I finished that trial at about 3:30 in the afternoon on Friday. I've got a brand new suit on. My wife bought me. And I'm going to the elevator bank, and there's some guy right behind me. And I turn around, and it's the guy that I didn't try his case. I represented his wife. And he looks at me, and he says, hey, Dick Face, we're going to take our own elevator down. And I said, hey, just get away from me. And I yell out for the bailiff. And there's not one bailiff that comes. I'm yelling, bailiff, bailiff. And he's poking me in the chest, you know, with his finger. And he says, so I think he's going to push me in an elevator. So I put my case down. And as I put my case down, his hands go up in a fighting position, clenched fist. And so I come up and I punch him in the nose. And he hits the deck. And basically, I'm trying to get, he's got my tie. He's flat on the floor. He's pulling my tie down, trying to choke me out and I'm yelling for help. The elevator door opens and this lady sees us and she starts screaming because of what's going on. And pretty soon the bailiffs come out. Yeah. We both get arrested. I get a criminal lawyer who tells me, Sullivan, they have him on camera coming back. He has no reason to be here except to get you. And I go, yeah. So the DA dismisses the case against me. But the funny thing is that the next day I go back into the courtroom. My partner said, Sullivan, don't do it because, you know, this thing needs to calm down. I said, look, I'll take my lumps. I'm going to go back into the courtroom. People are going to say what they want to say about me. So as soon as I go through the metal detectors, I hear, hey, John L. Sullivan, good job. These are from the bailiffs, you know. Yeah. And the sergeant pulls me aside and says, good job, Sullivan. We're just tired of these people pushing us around out here. And all of a sudden, I think I'm going to be the goat. And I ended up having all of these great comments about, yeah, good job. I thought, yeah, I wish I would have done that, but it happened.
And I'll say for our younger attorneys, that's probably not a good idea. However,
it's not a good idea.
What I do like is the older bailiff's reference to a historical figure. John L. Sullivan was one of the great heavyweight champions back in the 1920s. So I think 20s, 20s, 30s. So
something
like that. So very appropriate reference. So, all right, Richard. Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. What's a good way for our audience, if anybody wants to reach out and follow up on anything that you had to offer today, what's the best way to connect with you?
I would say on the internet, email at rsullivan@sullivan-law.com.
rsullivan@sullivan-law.com. We'll have that in our show notes. And I'll just say sullivan-law.com is also the website. Really very informative website. So everybody should go check that out. And again, want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur. And I look forward next time I'm out there in SoCal. Maybe
something be up for
a cup of coffee.
Please. Okay.
Sounds great. All right. Take care, Richard. Appreciate
you
it.
Too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls. Another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode. Our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.